Welcome to the Badlands, that overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day. Hello and welcome to the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. I'm Toby Napolitano, and we are back from a break. We got Hannah Gunn with us. How's it going, Hannah?
You're back from a break. I'm not back yet.
All right, Hannah's still on break. Michael Hughes, how are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing pretty good.
What's your break status? You're broken?
I'm broken. Yeah. Okay. It broke me.
Okay. Any interesting New Year's resolutions we should know about?
Consume less politics.
Consume less politics. Well, that's funny because probably starting at the next episode, we're going to have to, like, we've been, you know, floating around in the clouds doing, like, philosophy stuff, and we're probably going to have to dive back down into the muck and start talking about politics.
Democratic National Convention.
The Democratic primary is heating up, and that can't mean anything good. But we'll get to that next time.
So, like, all my New Year's resolutions, I will have violated it by February.
See, yeah. I, sometime in the 2000s, made a meta resolution not to make any resolutions because I don't care. So,
I think we should resolve to follow Finnish politics. New government includes 4 women, none of which are over the age of 36. And everything over there is looking pretty rosy and progressive.
Now, should we follow Finnish politics or should we just finish politics?
That's what I heard.
That's one of my best puns that I've ever made.
That's actually what I heard when she said it was, we should finish politics. And I was like, that's great.
That's a good idea. So anyways, over a month ago, we did an episode on privacy, which was centered around the thought that people should care about it. We sort of talked about why privacy is valuable, and we noted that a lot of people are kind of apathetic, even in the face of unprecedented restrictions to privacy that are happening, either via surveillance or online data collection, et cetera, et cetera. And it was basically a scare episode, right? We kind of went through all the terrifying things that are going on with respect to privacy.
Not all.
Was it not all?
Nah. We left a bunch of stuff out.
Go through all of them yet. No,
there's more
scary.
There's more scary stuff.
Yeah, you should be way more scared than you left that episode, of course.
That's actually all I did during my vacation was just, like, sit in the fetal position. And
I'm pretty sure at the end of that episode, Michael, you were so, like, had lost complete hope in the idea of privacy that I think you just gave up on the idea of passwords. You were just like, I don't see the point.
Yeah.
Anyways. What we didn't do, we alluded to a difficulty, philosophical difficulty, which has to do with the questions of a right to privacy, right? So we said privacy is valuable, but the question of whether you have a right to privacy and just what that right is and how far it goes is another question, right? I mean, there's all kinds of things that are valuable, like chocolate, which we don't necessarily have a right to.
Speak for yourself.
All right, and has a right to chocolate. things like the right to physical security, which we take ourselves to have a right to, but it doesn't mean that we can have all maximal security, right? We have to accept some risks. So there's questions about how far the right goes. So in this episode, we want to focus on this rights question, and we're going to discuss a couple of theories or views on the right to privacy, what it is and what kinds of cases it extends to, just what kinds of privacy limitations are privacy violations. At least for me, one of the things I'll have in mind is the online data collection, I think, in particular, is an interesting case, as we'll get to. Maybe I shouldn't get too much into that, but we'll end up there. So what is the right to privacy? That's the question.
Yeah, so that's a tough question, obviously. And there are a lot of different places we could start this conversation, but it seems like one natural place to start is with a skeptical view. And that's sort of where we left off as a possibility at the end of our last episode. There's this question of, well, is there really a right to privacy? Is there any need to talk about privacy specifically? Or, as Judith Jarvis Thompson has famously argued, is it the case that all of those things we talked about in the last episode where information was being acquired about us and distributed about us, were those all cases where the wrongness of what was happening with that information ultimately boiled down to a rights violation of some other kind, right? So Thompson basically thinks that when you look at most of the sorts of examples that we went through in that last episode, we can explain the wrongness of the way our information is being used by appealing to other kinds of more basic rights that are all familiar, that we'd all recognize. So one of those is a right to property. Basically, we have a right to control how our property is used. And part of that, according to Thompson, is the ability to control how people are able to access information about that property. And a similar right or a related right that's also often adequate for explaining the wrongness of the use of our information is a right to autonomy or liberty, right? That our right to control our bodies and ourselves gives us a right to protect certain information about our bodies. But Thompson ultimately doesn't think you need to appeal to any special right of privacy, because those will normally do the trick.
Yes, yeah, so I think it might be useful to just give some of her simple examples. So Thompson, if you haven't read Judith Jarvis Thompson, she has the most entertaining, fanciful examples of any philosopher that I can think of. So she has cases, and of course, they're always kind of a little bit weird, right? So it's like a man with a pornographic picture that he doesn't want anyone to see or to know that he has.
He keeps it safe in his house.
Right, and so like the example is the police have like this x-ray scanner that allows
them... Neighbor.
There is a variety of iterations, but right. Sure, make it whoever you want. And she says, like, this would be a privacy violation if someone uses their x-ray scanner machine to look at this pornographic picture that's kept in the safe, et cetera, assuming the person hasn't given permission, et cetera, to see it. And why? Because this person has a property right to that picture, and part of that property right is to restrict people from looking at it. Likewise with a diary, likewise with your body, right? And this is what she calls the right to person. So people don't have a right to just look at you, you know, when you're in your home, for instance.
It's more general than that, I think. I don't know how you guys interpret this, but one of the things that I take from the Thompson piece, and this especially when we're talking about the right to person stuff, is that the kind of view she sketches suggests there's just a huge cluster of rights over our person that we typically waive as just standard fare. So one example she uses that I think is quite useful is, imagine you're an opera singer. When I've taught this, I just say, just me as a singer, right? Because nobody gets to listen to me sing. Right?
Sure, I don't.
No, that's not a thing. You know, the cat's the only ones for whom I waive the right.
I've been trying to get that information out of Pudgy, but he hasn't broken yet.
Holding strong.
Yeah.
So, you know, usually if you were an opera singer, for instance, right, you've got this singing voice, it's a product, right? I think it's just easier to imagine if you're actually good at singing that this case makes sense, whereas I presumably am terrible at it, hence I don't let other people listen to me do it.
I think it makes sense in both.
Right, but so you charge people money as an opera singer to listen to your voice. You put it on CDs, they have to buy it. They have to subscribe to some of the, you know, many streaming services now to hear it. And if you suddenly decided you didn't want people to hear your singing voice, you can just deny them that access. Nobody has a right to hear your voice. In the normal course of the day, we just waive that, right? By and large, we don't really care about protecting the right over our person that would entitle us to deny other people to hear our voices or see various parts of our bodies, right? There are certain parts of our bodies where we do very much protect the privacy of other people seeing those parts of ourselves, but we don't apply those same kinds of protections to things like our hands or our noses, right? I don't know. Various other parts of the body are usually on display.
This is really interesting too, right? And this point about, as you started off by saying, in a lot of cases, we just sort of standardly waive these rights. So, like, interestingly, even in public, right, people don't have a right to, like, see through my shirt, right? See under my shirt. But presumably, if they see my hands and they're not being covered, then that's fine. Why? Because presumably the thought is, by going out in public with my hands uncovered, I'm at minimum signaling that I don't care. And presumably, like, if there's a, you know, a right to privacy and right to control whether my hand is seen or not, I've waived it by going in public and making it very difficult for people not to see it.
Right.
Right.
But if you had weird ears or something, which he doesn't.
Thanks. But if for a second there, it was like my self-esteem was hanging in the balance.
I cut you here. I'd leave it long if they needed to be hidden. You know, if you had weird ears, you could choose to hide those. And nobody else would be able to demand that you uncover your ears. Unless they were, I don't know, a Border Patrol agent or something. But that's sort of, you know, there's legal reasons there where sort of privacy rights can be forced aside. But yeah, so the thought is, for Thompson at least, if we're thinking about right to person and also rights over property, like, I could also prevent people from seeing what kind of computer that I own if I put it in a bulky enough case or something like that, right? That's a right over my property. Nobody is entitled or can demand to know what kind of coffee I drink or something like that, right? It's my property. We just usually waive those kinds of rights. So with respect to our person and then with respect to our property, there's just a cluster of rights that fall under those two big umbrella terms. And there's just a whole bunch of stuff that normally we waive.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So the take home again for her is that there's no special right to property, right? No special right to privacy. And we're talking about privacy and privacy violations. It can usually be explained by appeal to rights to property or rights to person. Now, interestingly, and Michael, I kind of want to get back to your initial statement of her view. There is a part in her paper where she says no one has a right to the information about themselves. No one has a right to any, like, facts about themselves. And so, and I think that nicely illustrates the limitations of her view. Because I think, as I understand it, information's kind of secondary. What the property rights and the rights to persons give you a right to is to restrict people from, like, perceiving you. It's not necessarily about information. The opera singer, he or she is not, you know, divulging information about themselves probably while they're singing. It's about sort of perceiving the voice. And she has another example where, and maybe we should just see where we stand on this, where our intuitions lie. Suppose you tell something to a friend, or maybe even a doctor, in confidence, with the understanding that they're not going to share this information to anyone else, and then they do. Doesn't she in that paper say that she does not think that's a violation of privacy? Like, once that information is had by someone else and someone goes and shares it, that's a different issue. It might be bad, but I don't think she thinks of it as a privacy violation.
I think there are two different cases. I think if you set it up as a doctor-patient relationship, then there might be a rights violation. There's clearly a rights violation in those sorts of cases. But in other cases where that person hasn't promised to or doesn't have a
But that's a broken promise, right? That's a different thing. It need not be a privacy violation, right?
Well, yeah, but for her, there's no such thing as a special privacy violation anyway, right? But there are rights violations that we would typically call privacy violations. And I think what's the difference between the case where the doctor violates a promise and somebody else violates your right to property, right? At the end of the day, it is some other right that's being violated for her. But I think what she explicitly points out, and even some people who think that there is a distinctive right to privacy agree with her on, is the fact that you don't have a right to privacy doesn't entail a right for others to not share information about you, unless, of course, they have some social role that they perform, which engenders such an obligation, or if somebody's made some explicit promise or something like that.
So this has consequences, I think, for instance, like for paparazzi and journalism.
Right.
She explicitly says she thinks, like, provided it's true, right, something like that, that journalists can publish whatever the heck they want about whatever, right, provided, again, they didn't use an x-ray machine or sort of illicitly obtain the information by violating, you know, one of these other rights to property or person.
Right. So like the example that she gives in the paper is somebody happens to overhear you telling a friend some information that you really only wanted to share with that friend. Well, this person who happened to overhear you doesn't have an obligation to then not repeat what they learned, because they didn't violate any right of yours by accidentally acquiring said information. That's something that they just happened to stumble into. And once
even if they know that you would not like that information shared and it's very what you would consider private,
right?
They don't have that.
So basically, there is no, in short, there's no obligation to not gossip or to distribute information about other people. When there are rights violations to privacy for her, it's typically the way in which the information was acquired. That's typically what we mean when we think that somebody's, when we talk of the right to privacy being violated. It's usually somebody has acquired information in a way that violated a right to person or a right to property.
And again, it need not even necessarily involve information, right? It could just be the sensory perception of property or person that you shouldn't have.
Right.
Usually you'll glean information from that, but it's a privacy violation for even if you don't necessarily draw any inferences or anything like that. So we start with Thompson's view, A, because it's skeptical, and B, insofar as it is trying to give explanations of our intuitions of privacy violations, it's very limited, right? It's a really kind of pared back view of privacy. And at least my intuitions go much farther than hers on how far privacy extends. So
it's also an early piece in philosophy of privacy.
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of, you know, it's an important piece to read, but worth highlighting where our intuitions start to diverge. And I'm just putting a flag on that. If we adopt this view, we're sort of trying to draw whatever this distinction between perceiving somebody in such a way that it would constitute a property or person privacy violation versus merely acquiring information about someone in such a way that doesn't conflict on those. I mean, that's a fuzzy boundary for me anyway, but as soon as we start to talk about big data and sort of social media data collection or anything like that, I just don't see how that's going to work.
Right.
Yeah.
So
shall we get to the Rachels?
Yeah, so I think this is probably a good point to transition to James Rachel's views on privacy and the way in which they differ from Thompson's, and I think problematize exactly this claim that we just considered, namely that you don't have a right to have information shared about you.
You don't have a right to not have it shared, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Too many negatives. So Rachel's starts by sort of first asking the question, okay, well, if there is something distinctive about privacy, and if there is really a right to privacy that's special and distinct from these other rights, well, what would explain that? And I think Rachel's really is quite helpful in sort of pointing out that we can come to appreciate why privacy matters to us if we stop focusing on the cases where there's certain kinds of information that we clearly have some reason to want to hide because they're shameful or embarrassing or could be used to manipulate us, and simply look at other cases where, in some ways, the information that we're concerned about being shared has no real negative social consequences for us by themselves, right? So it's not the sort of information that would lead us to be subject to scrutiny by the public that anybody would judge negatively. James Rachel says, I think we can start with cases where we recognize that privacy matters to us, even when we aren't going to be subjecting ourselves to any kind of social censure whatsoever, by sharing said information. And this will help us get to the heart of why having privacy is this really important thing that is really built into having complex social relations that are healthy.
Right. So what would be some examples? Like maybe like your taste in music, like, and assuming it's not particularly unusual or something, it's something no one cares about. It's not going to be a big deal if anyone finds out. Nevertheless, not everyone knows that about you. And you don't,
right.
It's not something you go telling everyone necessarily, just to take one mundane example.
Right. So there's that kind of thing. And then there's stuff that, is important, like your romantic relationships. Rachel says, like, suppose most people have, you know, romantic relationships that are in no way shameful, right? There's nothing shameful about them. Nevertheless, there are lots of different social roles that we occupy, which make it inappropriate for us to share that information with other people. So you consider employee-employer relationships, student-teacher relationships. It's just the nature of those relationships are such that we shouldn't share information about our romantic lives, at least, you know, in too much detail, with people that we stand in these relationships to. Unless, of course, those relationships evolve into genuine friendships and things like that. But that's in some ways what's constitutive of those kinds of relationships, is the levels of intimacy that we actually have with the people that stand in these different kinds of relationships.
Okay, so the thought is, if you don't have privacy, even over mundane stuff, then it makes it impossible for you to have the kinds of relationships that you want to have. So for instance, as you said, a teacher-student relationship, very specific, right? There's very specific kinds of norms and conventions about what each party to that relationship knows about the other. And there are certain things that are out of bounds because they are too intimate. And if you don't have control over that information, if somehow, right, a bunch of strangers come to know intimate details about you, you are in effect kind of forced into a level of intimacy which you do not want or do not consent to, or something like that.
I was thinking that's too strong. So, because I think just the way that you both described it is a little too strong. Because it makes it sound like we're still trying to protect certain kinds of information about ourselves from being known by other people, which in a way I guess is true, but I think it's more deflationary than that, right? It's more like you're an acquaintance of somebody's, if you know their name and you have run into them at a couple of meetings. You're a friend with somebody when you just know more about them, right? That's just one of the markers of friendship, is knowing a lot about somebody. With the student-teacher case, part of the problem with being too friendly with your students, it's not necessarily that they know anything in particular about you. It's just that it fundamentally changes the power dynamic of that relationship. It's much harder to be an objective grader or something if you're friends with somebody, because, I don't know, there's just lots of stuff that goes on there. So I just want to, I think for Rachel's and for Mama, who also makes a similar kind of,
well, I think we'll get to next
argument, along these lines, that having control over the kind of information you share with people and also the amount of information about yourself that you share with other people allows us to set up very different kinds of relationships. And it doesn't have to be any, so like the content is one thing that matters, and then it's like volume and quantity is another thing that matters. Like, I could want my students to know everything about my intellectual endeavors, right? I could want them to know everything about my degrees. I could want them to read every paper I've ever written, every review I've ever done, something like that. So they could have vast amounts of very specific, narrow information. That'll be fine. But a lot of low stakes, general information about my history would kind of make a friendship relationship that would be kind of not okay, even if there's nothing problematic.
It doesn't matter if it's okay or not. The point is that you're forced into it,
right,
by the fact that the information is out there and both parties know it. And you're like, I didn't want to have a friendship with this person, but now if it's true that having certain kinds of information about another person and vice versa are constitutive of being in that relationship, then you are ipso facto
right
in that relationship.
Social media profiles, I think, is one of the ways that we can think about the sort of information exchange radically changing really quickly and sort of changing people's relationships with other people very quickly. So if you, and obviously this can get more or less complicated, but if you had just left your, you know, perfectly regular social media profiles public rather than private, then lots of work or, you know, acquaintance, people who would otherwise have been acquaintances can know a whole lot of stuff about you. And that can sometimes make people feel like they're your friend, even though you don't know anything about them, right? This is something that people who stream video games and make YouTube
channels. All celebrities,
and
right, celebrities experience this.
Yeah, right. It's just a
movie
general
stars,
phenomenon. Yeah.
Athletes.
Your average person on the street, because they know everything about some celebrity, takes themselves to be a friend of the celebrity. And the celebrity is like, who are you? Get out of my life, right? Like,
So this is interesting, though, because so this obviously goes beyond Thompson's view. Right now, it's explicitly about information. We haven't had anything about, it's not about like seeing property or getting, you know, illicitly obtaining information about property or a person. This is a particular and distinctive value of certain kinds of information about you and having it and being able to control it.
Embarrassing or not.
Embarrassing or not.
Shameful or not.
Exactly. Yeah. I will offer, I wonder, I'll just throw this out here. This is kind of a theoretical, highly theoretical objection that I'm just wondering if Thompson could make and say, yes, you're right. This is an additional, cluster of privacy rights, but, doesn't this just show that these privacy rights that Rachel's is pointing to just reduce to like freedom of association, which you might think is a more basic right? This was just something I was wondering about. If there's that kind of claim to be made, because it seems like we're appealing to this like deeper right, perhaps, to choose the kinds of relationships that we are in, right? And there's this background assumption that it's bad if we are forced into friendships, for instance, that we don't consent to. Not important. You know, this is more of a philosophy talk objection,
right? Yeah,
than a podcast objection.
My initial I have another sort of just philosophical thought about what we just talked about. I mean, there's a couple different ways that you can interpret the constitutive claim, right? The claim that the kind of information that you have is constitutive of the relationship. I mean, it seems wrong to me to say you are friends with somebody, or at least partially friends with somebody, just because you have this kind of information. But rather, it's something like, instead, it's something like the social roles that you actually do stand in, or the social relationships that you do stand in, your ability to perform the associated social roles are undermined by their having said information. So it's not that you stand in that relationship, it's that it undermines the other relations that you do in fact stand in with those people, right? So like, just because you post online information that give your students access to your private life, that doesn't make them your friends, but it does undermine your capacity to perform the social role of teacher if they have that information.
Right, which is kind of what Hannah was
exactly. Yeah. But you can also think it is, maybe it's partially constitutive. It's not clear. It seems like you could read Rachel's it's saying either at times. But the important thing is really just that there is a reason, that the important thing that Rachel's brings out is that there is a reason that we want to control the flow of information about us. And it has to do with the social norms that grow up around the different kinds of social roles that we want to occupy. Even if what you're saying is correct, right, that there's this fundamental right of association that's really doing the explanatory work, I think what Rachel's can say is, okay, that's all fine and good, but the key thing to focus on is that there's particular social value to privacy rights that we can point to that explains why we care so much about privacy when we talk about privacy. And it doesn't really matter how we then reduce the rights violations, as long as we can explain what makes them a coherent set of rights claims.
I was just going to say, the way that we've introduced the sort of information and with respect to relationships has kind of been all about like, setting up or creating relationships, where sometimes privacy matters for protecting or maintaining certain kinds of relationships. I'm thinking about a lot of people with respect to their families, for instance. And this obviously comes up in employer cases as well, but there's lots of things for people who they they just don't want their family to know certain things about them, right? It would fundamentally change their relationship to their family. It just sometimes, so as much as protecting information enables relationships, right, by allowing you to create them or maintain them, it also allows you to preserve them.
Right.
Right. And so the idea that, it's kind of weird. So if you think about the kind of right to information thing just in the abstract, if we don't have that, then the default is something like complete honesty. Always everywhere. And that seems false.
Whereby honesty, you don't just mean honesty in terms of not lying, but like full disclosure all the time of everything.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, and that's... And I guess the Thompson person would push back and say, well, it's not full honesty all the time about everything, because if it's your property or your person, then you've got some reason to keep it protected. But if you don't have that secondary and more basic, like, more fundamental reason to keep that information private, then you have no grounds to keep it private. And I generally think we don't, at least our intuition usually isn't that way. It's not like public unless I have some justification for keeping it private. It's more like private unless I let you know about it or something, right? Even the really mundane stuff.
So I think this lets us make a nice transition to one of the other pieces we read by Andre Marmer, who I think he uses this exact kind of thought experiment, right, where he says, imagine kind of a world of no privacy, full disclosure, full honesty. And like Rachel's, I think he ends up going a little bit farther than Rachel's, but he emphasizes the kind of social importance of being able to present yourself the way you want to other people, like having some control over how you present yourself to others. Obviously, he can kind of take on a lot of the things that Rachel said with respect to maintaining and relationships and being in the kind of relationships that you want. But then also how crucial it is to sort of like our self-image and dignity. It seems like sort of a basic kind of human thing to be able to kind of, again, kind of control how you are presenting yourself to the rest of the world.
I think he does two versions. So one is the global panopticon. So imagine that you wake up in the morning and all of the walls, windows, anything that previously allowed spaces to be closed off from one another, glass. It's all glass.
You don't even need the x-ray machines now.
No, you don't need x-ray machines. There's no doors on bathrooms. Just everything's just out, visible, available. So global panopticon, everything is visible, nothing can be hidden.
Like a real-time Google street, or like... it's real-time video.
So that's like the first part. And the second one, I think you might even call it total honesty, then maybe we're getting that phrase from. At least I think I wrote that in my handout for one of my classes. Which is no protection of your thoughts as well. So not only is everything you do, so action-wise, and physical body-wise and things like that visible, sort of panopticon version, but the second one is your thoughts aren't even just in your head anymore. And that's sort of, that's another little dimension of privacy, maybe it'll come up again later. But we generally take ourselves to have privileged access to the content of our own minds. Some people think that's really important for privacy. That can come up with the data stuff again later, but you know, if there is no information about ourselves that we have sort of a presumptive right to keep hidden, then, well, we shouldn't care about either global panopticon or total honesty.
There's, have either of you seen The Invention of Lying?
No. I'm familiar enough with it film.
It's a film that is the thought experiment of total honesty sort of playing out. Right, and why that would be such a hellscape to live in, right? Like, you have to imagine the ways in which that impacts, again, people's ability to stand in certain kinds of social relations, right? If you can't hide your thoughts about other people at any point, it is very hard to maintain healthy relationships for obvious reasons.
Is Liar Liar the non-dystopian version of that film? Because Liar Liar is trying to teach us the importance of honesty, right? That's Jim Carrey's character. Well, that's his problem is he lies all the time.
No, Liar Liar's point is that some things do need to be hidden.
And that kids don't understand that.
Yeah, so it's like he asks, you know, his kid asks him, you know, is it true that beauty's only skin deep? And he just says, no, that's something ugly people say.
So this is interesting. Actually, this is what Rachel starts out with his paper with. He doesn't use this language, but so are you saying that we shouldn't be real all the time?
Yeah.
Like in this, wait, no, it's interesting though, right? Like this is a, Rachel's explicitly says this, is this kind of common thought sometimes amongst people, I think around you. It's really prominent in hip hop, right? This idea that you should kind of act the same always. It shouldn't change regardless of who you are around. And if you do change how you act around different people, then you're not real.
Well, I honestly thought you were going to say politics, because I'm pretty sure that's American politics.
That's also true, yeah.
It's stressed more in hip-hop.
So it's funny that... So this is exactly something that Rachel's takes up.
Yeah, right? Well, that's what I was saying. That, right, he starts with this.
People perceive that any sort of difference in behavior as an attempt at deception and dishonesty, and that that's somehow bad. And what Rachel's points out is, again, no, your ability to be in one kind of relationship with a person and a different kind of relationship with a different person may mean that you engage with those people and behave with those people differently depending on the social roles.
So like you don't treat your mom like your colleague or vice versa, right? Seems obvious. It would be interesting actually there's probably an interesting paper to be written, probably has been written, about what exactly is meant in the hip hop context, because I doubt it's exactly this, but yeah, no, it just reminded me of this. In any case.
So lying and deception and misleading, right? That's just sort of a lazy collapsing of all of those categories and very heavily sort of weighs on the assumption that omission is always lying. Where omission, so leaving certain kinds of information out, is not lying. There might be some cases where we think, given the context, it amounts to a lie, perhaps, right? This is where we can start getting really sort of philosophical and nitpicky, but it certainly would be bad to assume that all leaving outs of certain kinds of information constitutes lies, deception, or misleadings. So that seems false.
And not to mention, of course, that some disclosures and non-omissions are overshares, exactly. Right? This is what this concept is about, right? We don't want to know everything about everyone. I think it's kind of illustrates on the other side the kind of the social importance of keeping some information private.
Right. That was a crossword clue we had recently. Nice. Yeah. We've started doing crosswords.
Yeah, we're getting better.
Oh, good.
It's hard, man. Too many names, too much pop culture. I don't know.
Oh,
I don't know,
so pop culture. We just infer those. We infer the vowels in names by filling out the other clues.
Amy and I went through that phase a while ago. And then, yeah, they're hard. And yeah. It was also just like, it was cutting into my gaming time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's unacceptable. They're pretty mentally taxing if you spend
time. It was like, I was either going to play video games or I was going to do something like that. And it was like,
easy choice.
I'd rather play video game.
So one of the things that Thompson mentions is important and that Mama also thinks is important is the sort of the way that the information is accessed, right? So if people steal information about you, whether or not we think it's a distinctive privacy right or it matters because it's a privacy right that ultimately reduces to something else like property or person, the stealingness makes it bad, right? So Marber takes the sort of access of information a little bit further to point out one of the ways that privacy and privacy protections are changing with new technologies. Because if you're thinking about your stuff, like you have very real control over your stuff, right? You put it places, public, private, you lock it in safes or not, just neighbors have x-ray goggles, whatever. But you kind of, you know, you have control over your person to a reasonable extent. You have control over your property to a reasonable extent. But if we're thinking about big data collection, so public surveillance, social media surveillance, search engine personalization, smart speakers, any of that kind of stuff. We don't have the kind of control over that kind of information, over that kind of information gathering about us that we might have had over information about us in the past. And so that's one of the things I think is important from that Mama piece, is we have to think about how control over information is changing. And I kind of want to bring this up later as well. There's a whole lot of information about us that we do not have any control over. And actually, we haven't thought we needed to have any control over that kind of information, but is incredibly important and we might want to have privacy protect.
And so he suggests, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but that the way he conceives of the right to the privacy, the right to control information about you, it kind of follows from that we have a right to an environment which can make that possible, right? So like having cameras and microphones everywhere, even in public, for instance, might make that impossible, or maybe the nature of the internet right now might make that impossible. And so not having an environment which allows for this kind of control over our information might in and of itself be a violation of privacy.
Yeah, I can't remember. He thinks we have a right to certain kinds of environments, but that we have to attend to the ways in which our environment might make us lose control of a right that we ought to be able to exercise. I can't remember how it breaks down, but yeah.
Right. So there are some ways in which Rachel's goes further than that Marmer goes further than Rachel's, right? As you were just explaining, the ways in which the right to have an environment that allows for privacy is something that simply doesn't come up in the Rachel's. At the same time, there are some interesting ways in which Rachel's, I think, actually goes further than Marmer, and explicitly so. So Marmer, I think, at one point agrees with Thompson on this point that one does not have a right to not have information shared about you for others, not have a right for others to not know things about you. So in the go back to the case of the person who's sitting on the park bench who accidentally overhears you sharing information with an intimate friend, I think both Marmer and Thompson will think, well, there was no violation of that person's right to not have that information learned by that person. And in addition to that, there is no obligation of that person to then keep that information secret, right? That person who overheard you has the right to share information about you if they're so inclined.
And more specifically, just to be clear, they might have an obligation because maybe it's a horrible thing and they know they're going to harm you by spreading it, but the obligation does not come from, it's not a rights violation, right? And right. This is one of the things that always makes rights discussions difficult, right? Because you have cases and you have intuitions about, like, is something bad happening here? And you might be like, yes, but it doesn't follow as a rights violation, of course, right? Because there are other things that could make it wrong. But I just wanted to clarify that.
Right.
Right. So yeah, interestingly then, so Marmer does allow for potentially mass sharing of information provided it's obtained in the right way.
Right. Paparazzi and gossiping, as long as it's acquired the information in ways that you could predict and you kind of chose to expose to them, is free game. Mm-hmm. For Rachel's, I think, disagrees, or at least provides the grounds for disagreeing with that, by pointing out that by sharing this intimate information with other people, you thereby prevent a person from being able to choose the kind of relationships they might stand in. So go back to the teacher case. So if somebody happens to have learned intimate romantic information about you and then decides to share that with your students, that person's thereby deprived you of the ability to fully, or they've at least harmed your ability to perform this social role of teacher by sharing that information. And I think, I can't remember if Rachel says outright that there then is this right to privacy, which actually does go so far as to protect information from being shared. I think so, but even if not, I think you can see the grounds for that in the Rachel's piece.
Something weird I just thought of And I think I might have had this reaction when I was reading Thompson the first time. In the opera singer case, right, she thinks the right to person includes not being heard.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So sound waves that you emit, it's not directly perceiving your body, but sound waves that you emit, hearing those, can potentially be privacy rights violations. Why not information that causally is emitted from you? Right? Is there, like, it just seems like a, I don't know, I'd want to know more about why information is special for her such that, like, no, facts are public in a way that your sound waves aren't.
So I don't know the Luciana Floridi work on privacy well. I should know it right now better than I do, but I don't know it right now better than I should. What did I say? I don't know.
We got anyway.
This is one of those Bilbo Baggins.
But part of Floridi's view on privacy, and Floridi is one of the philosophers who really works on informational privacy specifically, and is very concerned around doing work on sort of data ethics stuff. But Floridi takes digital information, or trying to remember how much of what I'm about to say is me making it specific to a particular class, and how much is sort of the general view. But I'll put it in a weaker but more encompassing way, which is that information about us is constitutive of our identities. So it really matters to have control then over information, over your information. And this is just with this ambiguity about, like, well, what information's about me comes in. But if information about you is constitutive of your identity, then, I mean, that is a way to very quickly make all of this information about you stuff have a lot of moral weight, right? Because what's more important than your identity and having control over your identity and having control over how others perceive you, right? Which is just to say the sort of access to the information about your identity, right? So that matters. But then, yeah, if we're coming to this question of, okay, are we meant to be reducing the opera singer's singing to their emission of sound waves? Or is it important that it's an opera singer singing? Because if you reduce it down to sound waves, then you're like, well, light refracting off my body is also information about me. But that might be reducing it too far. Like, it might matter that it's the opera singer singing. Like, that's the level of abstraction that is morally significant. And if you reduce it down to just the sound waves you emit into the world, that's, like, that's not significant anymore. Because there's ways in which people perceiving me, like looking at me, might matter for privacy, but mere light reflectances off me doesn't. That's a reduction too far. So that's, I don't know.
Interesting.
And that's where the information stuff.
But you'd want an argument as to
You want to know, like, yeah, which level of abstraction do we stop at? And this is where the data privacy stuff starts to get really complicated, because a lot of the information that's collected about you digitally, it's not quite light reflectance level, but it's certainly not singing voice level.
So why don't we talk in a little bit more detail about these online data collection cases where, I mean, as we talked about in the last episode on privacy, there's lots of different things that are being collected. But this question of, is it identifying information or is it information about you? Do you have any kind of special right to this information? It becomes difficult in these kinds of cases. I mean, if you think, for instance, of the, you know, one of the controversial and really public kinds of examples is the NSA collecting metadata of phone calls and things like that, right? It's data about your phone calls, but it doesn't, well, actually, I don't know. Do we know everything that's in that information? Like, that information that is collected?
I don't work for the NSA, so.
The thought is, right, it can be kind of like quasi-anonymized, right? It's not like Michael Hughes made this call at this time and said these things to this person.
So I think the...
Maybe for the NSA it is.
To me, the intuitions you can get at, even without the complexities of the digital information. And like, I've found the sort of other examples that aren't really about, you know, metadata, because it's so because that's so complicated as to what that actually is. There's questions about, like, how much can you really infer from the metadata, like how much is it about you? In part depends on, well, how much can you use, you know, complex algorithms to extrapolate additional information beyond the mere raw data that's collected. That gets really complicated really fast. I think it's helpful to go back to some of the philosophical views when trying to think about this stuff to help sort of bring out, well, why is it supposed to matter that it's about you or not? So Hannah already pointed out that for digital information, if that's part of your identity, right, then you can see that anything that really is about you and helps to, can be used to build a theory of who you are and impact your ability to control people's perception of who you are, undermines your capacity to control your identity and how you present to the world. And as Marmer has argued, that's important.
But we should get Marmer's example out on the table then. He explicitly says, if someone has a weird kind of x-ray camera that lets you take pictures of people from the neck down and lets you see under their clothes, so they're kind of, you get like neck down naked pictures, and we're assuming that these aren't identifying, so you, I guess, does he say this, so that you don't know who it is, right. He doesn't think that's a violation of privacy, which is very interesting. That seems wrong to me, but it's fascinating.
So it depends. So this is where maybe there's a problem with Rachel's theory, because if you were to take Rachel's theory first, right, where it's about your ability to perform certain social roles, it's clear that if people cannot identify it as you, then it's hard to see how that information being out there would undermine your capacity to perform your social roles or choose the kind of relationships that you're in. Right, so it doesn't threaten some of the important social goods that we might link to privacy. And I mean, there's another question of, well, would it actually threaten your ability to control your identity if you sort of generalize that in the way that Hannah had suggested? And again, it's hard to see how it doesn't give you control over your identity. And nevertheless, it does seem to me like a case where it can nevertheless inflict a serious harm upon you and a social harm upon you, even if it's not the case that it threatens your ability to control your identity or to control the kinds of social relationships that you're in.
Something's wrong with the case, because there are, like, we have many reasons to be incredibly upset about cameras being installed in public toilets and taking pictures of people doing the toilet business, even though their faces aren't involved, right? Like, that's a fucking problem.
Well, so interestingly, this is an example where Thompson goes for, like, her account actually does account for this.
Yeah,
and so maybe Marmer and Rachel's would agree that, yes, Thompson's right about this case. This is about right to person, but not whatever is distinctive about privacy. Privacy is, strictly speaking, something else. Maybe it requires information that is identifying. It seems like for Rachel's and Marmer, it does need to be that, because otherwise it just doesn't have the relevant social consequences. And so Maybe they deal with this case by saying, oh, this is a violation of a right to person, but not privacy. And now it's sort of, you know, theoretical distinctions between how we carve up the rights. But it's interesting because it does feel like, surely if anything's a privacy violation, like that is.
Well, I was thinking of even more. So I originally, when I read this example, thought of the lightsaber kid, who was one of the sort of first videos to go viral on the internet, where this kid was like absolutely humiliated in front of the country by having this video of himself being goofy displayed and watched by millions and millions of people.
Which is a kid playing with a broom handle and pretending it's a lightsaber for people who haven't seen the video. I mean, that's the content. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty good. Lightsaber work, if you ask me.
Yeah, no, I mean, people have put special effects over at the top of it, putting in sort of the background scene and a lightsaber, and he's good.
It's great.
Good job.
But you can imagine a variant on that case where they were also wearing a Darth Vader helmet, right? And maybe they were in a garage that wasn't theirs, so you couldn't actually identify who that person is. So you can't identify who that person is. Still, you might think this kind of information being out there for the world can have serious psychic harm. So imagine this person doesn't have to worry ever about somebody identifying it as them, right? The mere knowledge that the entire nation is laughing at them, even if everybody else doesn't know it's them, is the kind of thing that can have serious psychic harm for a person, even though it's not identifying information. And in a lot of these cases, it seems to me that that's another aspect of that information being out there.
That's fascinating.
I think that that's right, but it's not clear to me it's got anything to do with privacy. People keep lots of weird things that they do private because they know how others will respond to it. And it's not clear there's anything about privacy that's more about like self-image and constructing a personal identity that you can be, I don't know, proud of and that you think is respected and things like this.
Right.
And that, I don't know, that seems to be a whole it does lot seem of like- other stuff, right? Because it's kind of like, fuck. Like, everybody just saw this kid doing that. I do that. Who doesn't pretend they have a lightsaber when they're holding a broom handle? Like, everybody does that. Now I know how people would respond if
right.
they saw me doing it. That would cause me to feel immense amounts of shame and embarrassment, da 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 da. So I don't want anyone to know, right? Because it doesn't even have to be myself anonymized and I know that it's me that they're looking at in order to get those same kinds of yucky feelings.
Right.
Right. That's kind of what I'm getting at. Like, if I had also made lightsaber videos, I've got home videos, me and my best friend doing fake Olympics. There's stuff on there I don't want people to, you know. But if I is sufficient to see other people responding to anonymous strangers behaving in the same ways for me to get the same kinds of, you know, mental stress.
Right. Certainly the same kinds. Probably not the at the same level as the poor lightsaber kid.
No, for sure.
Yeah, I think that was also my intuition. That was one of the reasons why I struggled with some of the stuff last time as to whether it's really about privacy at all. Or it seems like there are a lot of different kinds of social goods. But they're clearly related to each other.
And yeah, one of the ways I think it does start to intersect back with privacy, and we're sort of talking about these kinds of being able to keep things hidden or not, is that it has serious chilling effects, which is kind of what I'm describing, right? It's sufficient for me to know how other people respond to certain actions that other people perform for me to not also perform those kinds of actions. And so if you're thinking about, there's just a way that the sort of crime deterrence stuff is meant to work, right? You make an example of certain people behaving in certain ways so that other people know how not to behave. Otherwise, they will get certain kinds of punishment. And that's a way to try to restrict people's behaviors by controlling what actions people do or don't perform in public, things like that. So if you've got this sort of full surveillance culture, then maybe nobody is, you know, using broom handles as lightsabers anymore, because everybody knows how people respond.
And that's a great loss.
And that's a great loss to society. And so there are chilling effects that happen even with these kinds of anonymous cases that are privacy concerns, but it's not a privacy concern for the individual per se, but it's one of these consequences of a massive loss of privacy that you get these chilling effects that affects people's behavior. Those chilling effects wouldn't exist if certain things were able to be private. But I don't know, this is where the sort of freedom of association, freedom of speech complications start to come back in again. One reason to not want the global panopticon society where everything is visible, where all metadata is available, is because sometimes you want to be able to talk to people and not have other people know who you're talking to. Or if people knew you were talking to certain people, they might make certain inferences that would be bad for you. And so it would be better if you were able to have those kinds of interactions private. So it's complicated, but yeah, I don't know.
I want to know about the online case now. Enough dodging, Michael. Hannah, I remember you describing to me a really interesting a defense, an analogy that's used to defend the collection of online browsing behavior, whatever, which is the footsteps in the sand metaphor.
I can't remember if we did this in the last episode or not.
Okay.
So the thought is, so you have the metadata kind of case, right? So government surveillance is tracking who's talking to who when, right? Which phone model talked to which phone model at this time from this state, which I might say is very specific anonymous data, which is something I was going to interject earlier, right? The extent to which it's anonymous is kind of, you know.
Well, it's weird. It's like a neck down nude photo, very specific, hopefully anonymous data, but yeah.
Right. Well, so the point I'm getting at is that it's not anonymous, but anyway, and this will be true of lots of kinds of digital information collection. So not just the kind of NSA collection stuff, but anything that Google, your Gmail is keeping tabs on you, all of the Facebook advertising algorithms that are following you everywhere you go online, right? All of these, whatever DoubleClick is, I think that's one of the Google subsidiary, I can't remember, but another one of these advertising companies. Okay, so they are harvesting all kinds of information about where you're going, what you're clicking on, how long you're looking at stuff, what's going in your cart, what's being taken out, that kind of thing. So that feels to us like our information, and it feels to us like the kinds of information that we should be able to say to companies, no, you can't track that about me. So the analogy to the beach is meant to be like this, right? So you go to the beach in the morning, and you notice some footsteps already in the sand, and those footsteps, you know, they veer off to the left and they go and hang out by some rocks, and then they seem to walk up to the water surface, and then they go to an area that's sort of padded down in a way that suggests that maybe a towel was laid out, and then the footsteps sort of leave the beach again and they, you know, went to their car and left, right? You don't know who that person is, but you've got a pretty accurate trace of how they walked across the beach and left. So for the person who left those footsteps, do they have any right over your ability to look at those footsteps, take pictures of those footsteps, video them, make inferences about the fact that they went and looked at boulders, went and looked at the ocean and took a nap, perhaps, right, before leaving for their car? Like, in the footsteps case, it seems like, nah, I mean, those are footsteps on a beach. The person who left them has no control, no ownership over those footsteps. And so the argument for digital privacy is meant to be sort of similar, right? You leave kinds of digital footsteps on the internet every time you click something, look at something, leave a tab open, anything like that. And all these companies are doing is harvesting all of that kind of information.
This is the argument against digital privacy.
Right. So it's no different.
Yeah. It's like a Thompson-style objection, right? They're like, look, you create this information. Do you own it? No. Right? And so it's like a Thompson kind of thing. Like, you don't own the information. The relevant question is whether you have the property right over the thing. And it's not yours. It's just there. We're just looking at it.
If you could, the problem obviously is like, if you could use the footsteps to predict what kind of hot dogs to sell me and other things that are bad for me, then I might actually think, nah, I don't want you to actually be able to record all this information about my footsteps after all.
So it's interesting. So
like a podiatrist or something, like I can see exactly how their foot is landing. This person's got some rotation issues. Also, their feet are really big. This guy's going to need some big shoes. You know, hangs out at the beach.
You bring your business cards and you're like, you know,
yeah, just leave them at the footsteps.
So that's interesting. Like, I agree. Like, you know, imagine there's someone whose job it is at the beach to go around and analyze the footprints, and then when they can get a robust enough profile that when someone like you comes in, they can kind of predict how they should market concessions to you. That feels weird. But is that, I can imagine it's objective. Well, that's not a privacy violation in that case. The problem is that you don't like being manipulated by advertisers. And yes, they're using this information for it, but they can use all kinds of things, that all kinds of information that we would probably consider completely public.
I mean, my intuition is sort of similar to Hannah's, about the earlier case, where, yeah, maybe that's not actually really about privacy. But at the same time, again, it's not having a collection of norms protecting privacy in these cases has a massive chilling effect and much more.
And honestly, what this discussion does is, like, it kind of pushes you to just saying, well, why not just have, like, a consequentialist justification? and just say, look, we know this leads to manipulation. We know this leads to chilling effects. We know this leads to blah, 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 all these social harms. That's enough to think that there is a pretty robust right to privacy and control over this information, which you know, might be quasi-public or quasi-anonymous. And it really depends on how is it typically used. And if it's typically used in ways that are morally objectionable, then we have reason to protect that right to control the information.
I don't think it's enough. Because it's gonna depend what harms you think you ought to be tallying and da da da. Also, I don't chilling effects. It's kind of weird utilitarian counterfactual sums of what you maybe would have done in other circumstances. So they'll get complicated in some ways. But
you can do the liberty move.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know. I think looking to consequences, I think, asks too much. At least there's a strong intuition in a lot of cases that if we just go back to that, what we were pushing back against on the Thompson view, like people don't have a right to, well, sorry, there's, you do have a right to keep information about you private, whether there's going to be consequences for people knowing that or not. Right. That's the mm-hmm. thought that I'm trying to get to. So if we've got the kind of consequential, well, when they collect this data, they manipulate your actions and it has these chilling effects, da 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 da. Well, that requires that there has to be some sort of bad effect for people to come in and know that information about you. And I don't know that that's quite the privacy intuition, at least not in some cases. Right. Because the thought is, no, I mean, you're just not, it's not sort of an open pass. You can just learn about me anything that you're capable of learning about me. No, right? Like, I think the strong privacy intuition is we're private entities unless we waive or consent.
That's my view.
Access to others.
And I think right? in a lot of the cases where we don't think there's a problem, and a lot of the cases where these authors say there isn't a problem, can easily be explained by saying, well, there's the way you've set up the situation, it's plausible that someone is waiving their right. Or, right. again, in some cases, right, if you're sitting in a park bench minding your business and then a couple sits down next to you and starts arguing, having a really intimate kind of argument, you can't avoid getting that information in that case. And in that case, we would tend to think that this person is blameless because they couldn't do anything to avoid it. And so we tend to think that it's not a rights violation. So I am sympathetic to that view, but we've gone on kind of long here, so we need to get to this last point, which you just kind of bring up. And this brings us back to another complication of these some forms of online data collection and other forms of data collection, which is that, but to take the social media examples, one of the things that people do when they sign up is they click I agree to terms and conditions, which specify in some form or other what you can expect with respect to privacy. And we should note, right, like this is a feature of rights in general. You can grant special permissions. You can waive rights in certain circumstances. So for instance, with respect to property, you know, I have the right to not let Michael use my basketball, but sometimes I can waive that and let him use it temporarily, right?
You could even transfer your right to your basketball. I could.
I won't.
To Michael.
He has way too many basketballs.
But
I have exactly the right number of basketballs.
We also had a lot of basketballs.
We have like one now.
Yeah, but I said had.
Yeah, but Michael probably has like 18. But anyways.
Seven or eight at most.
So the obvious objection that the collectors of data will say is, and people say this all the time, and even not even people who are sympathetic to those companies, but an average person will say, well, just don't use the service then. Why do you click I agree. You consent to it. Mm-hmm. Just like you consent to giving up medical information to your doctor, and that's fine. You don't have to if you don't want to. The heck?
Oh, the obvious problem with that last thing of, oh, you don't have to is, I mean, it's not just social media, right? It's like your bank options. Like, are you going to not, you're going to give up
yeah.
online
some
banking?
Some things are essential, even if some people like to cast them as luxuries. They're essentially essential. But what about the social media case, though? Because I take it that we think that's a paradigm kind of problematic case, even if people click I agree.
Mm. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to be said. I think on this one bullet point on consent, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 top line comments with sub comments, so I'll try not to do all of them. But I think one thing that's useful here, Oh, it's okay. Two. Can I do two? One of these isn't on my list, but I'm going to do it anyway. So first off is how we think about consent. And how we think about consent is pretty heavily informed, at least this is my take on it, by how we understand consent in the medical context. So in biomedical ethics, there's those four principles of biomedical ethics, and one of them is autonomy. So in order for your doctor to do right by you, they have to ensure that you make autonomous decisions. In order for you to make autonomous medical decisions, you need to be free from internal and external constraints. So you can't sort of have, you know, family members forcing you to have some sort of procedure. And also if you're kind of in distress or mentally unwell drunk. In certain kinds of, or drunk, yeah, go with an easy case. That's what I wanted, drunk, right? Yeah. Then that's an internal constraint that means that you can't also, you know, act autonomously. But one of the big sort of pillars there for autonomy is informed consent. And informed consent requires that you're capable of giving consent, which just requires these internal and external constraints to not be put on you. But you need to be able to understand what it is that you're consenting to, and you need to be able to make an informed decision about consenting or not consenting, right? Giving permission or not giving permission. So you need to know like what it is and what your options are, like what your other options are. So when you guys are mentioning like this medical context where you kind of have to give up some of your data to get it, that's a case where your options are limited. There might be some cases where your options are limited in ways that are problematic, right? Where it's give us your information or don't get this thing. If we think that you have this a
crucial
right,
thing that
right,
you can't
yes.
possibly get by without.
Right. So it doesn't matter if the thing that you really wanted to get access to was like, I don't know, whatever 2020's version of Tamagotchi pets are, right? That was just the thing that popped into my head just now. I don't know.
Fascinating.
Right. So, you know, that's sort of a bizarre luxury good that plausibly is not essential for anybody. So if some companies like give me all of your personal private information and you can have one of these, like that's sort of a limit of choice where you're like, yeah, okay, I guess I won't have the 2020 Tamagotchi pet. That's kind of fine. But there are other cases where like you really need that thing or you have a right to that thing. So it's kind of holding you hostage to certain choices that wouldn't be permissible. So if we think about consent, that kind of informed consent model, it becomes really easy to see what some of these problems with the checkbox terms and conditions are. Nobody's meeting those informed consent criteria.
So from the social media case, presumably it's not, I imagine we're not treating this as an essential good. So rather it's that the consent isn't informed.
So the consent wouldn't meet the various parameters that we put on consent for consent to be legitimate. This is where I want to get to my second kind of point. So the first is just, if we're assuming that the kind of consent that is required, and this is an assumption, right? But if we're assuming that the kind of consent that we want for data collection and stuff so that privacy violations don't occur or privacy infringements don't happen is informed consent, then we're setting ourselves a pretty high bar, right? Because we need people to understand what it is they're consenting to. They need to understand what their other options are. They need to have a relevant range of choices, need to be free from these kinds of constraints. So it's a pretty high bar of consent to meet. That in itself might be problematic. Then you've got whether or not the checking the tick box is in fact the right kind of action to constitute consenting. So there's a nice distinction in this paper by Bart Custers and et al. And I'm just going to say et al. Because some of the names I know I'm going to butcher. So I'm not going to say them.
We'll have the link on...
That's out of respect.
Badlandsphilosophy.com.
So one of the nice distinctions, and this is just, it's just a piece on privacy and consent, and specifically with this kind of digital information in mind. So they make this nice distinction between accepting terms and conditions and agreeing to the contents of terms and conditions. So it's sufficient for the like legal validity of consent that you accept by checking the box. But like philosophically, where we want something a little bit deeper, we want consenting to cause some sort of worldly change, whatever that is, right? But it's what informed consent has that like a gun to your forehead consent doesn't, right? Whatever that special change is meant to be, that's meant to come from the agreement thing. So if we don't just want people to be accepting terms and conditions, which might make it valid, we actually want them to agree to the contents of what it is that they're signing, then just checking a box won't be sufficient. And what that agreeing to the contents does is that kind of gives you a meaningful consent mechanism by which we think the relevant change has happened, such that, you know, rights have been waived or transferred or whatever the kind of special rights transaction is meant to be in that case. So for the social media case, you might accept the terms and conditions, but your checking the box might not be the action type that is appropriate for meaningful consent, such that rights have actually been transferred, waived, whatever.
And why not? Because they don't specify exactly what's going to happen with this information.
So they could
be impossible for you to predict.
Right. So, well, both of those could count, right? So the one way is that, so people don't read those policies. So if informed consent is at bar, they fail already. You're not going to get.
Which is interesting because, you know, they might say, well, we put the thing there for them to read it. But that's beside the point here, because
right.
If consent is what's mattered, if that's what matters, then if they don't read it, regardless of whether
consented.
You put it in front of their face and read it out loud to them, if they don't pay attention to it, that's not good enough.
Right. So the first issue is whether or not people read the policies. Obviously, that's required for agreeing to the contents of the policies, because if you haven't read it, you don't understand it, you can't agree to it. So people don't read it. Even if people do read it, they often don't understand it. I'm sure all of us and probably many of our listeners have tried to read some of these terms and conditions documents, and they're legalese that is incomprehensible. So you don't read it, or you do read it, you don't understand it. Or you read it, you get some sort of understanding, but you don't have the relevant background information to understand why various caveats are being made and what your alternatives are and da-da-da, what the options are, what the entailments are of this policy. Or your choices are just too limited, right? So there are all kinds of ways in which the checking the terms and conditions box might not amount to consent in the ways that we think matters.
Is that the paper, or is it Sullivan, another paper, who argues that informed consent is impossible in these kinds of cases?
So that comes up in both of these places,
okay.
Both these places. I mean, this is just one of the things. If we take informed consent to be the model of consent that we want for data collection and protection and for privacy, then we're kind of setting ourselves up to fail, at least with the ways that things presently are. But there is this question about whether or not that is the kind of consent we think we should need or want.
Right, that's a really interesting caveat, because you might think, like, in the other kind of case, when you're talking about the medical case, we're usually thinking about really crucial either life and death situations or questions about the, you know, what your body's going to be like. And you might think that those are more important and more fundamental and so require a higher bar.
Right, but it also, like, it's important here what kind of data collection we're talking about. And so if you're talking about social media terms and conditions, that's one thing. You're talking about your medical insurance company collecting your data, that's another thing. But there are other kinds of data collection that we don't think require consent and that we don't think require informed consent. And that's a lot of government data acquisition. We just think the government has a right to gather information about its citizens. And that actually is one of the reasons why some of this data collection stuff is becoming so problematic, is because of this weird kind of merging that's happening between private and government data collection mechanisms and these new entities called data intermediaries who aggregate and collect vast amounts of public and private data and then sell it to people who want to buy it, researchers or not, right? Private companies or not. That's kind of another conversation. But there are certain kinds of data collection that we have never required informed consent or even really consent beyond assuming the government is legitimate, I guess. So maybe there is a kind of consent there, but that's
I've been reading political philosophy, and it turns out no, the government's not legitimate.
Okay, so we'll just bench that as just, you know, maybe that's
I was
not
gonna name specific authors, and I was like, no, any political philosophy.
Yeah, so there's data collection that predates a lot of the data collection we've been talking about is problematic that we don't actually think requires consent. So that kind of brings us to this question of do we want consent, do we need it, what's the model we should be using? And honestly, I think we would need a third episode to talk about the data intermediaries mess to really start to get into some of these.
We would need a third. We need a semester.
Well, that's, yeah.
to unpack most of this shit. But what I was going to say is, like, if you try to, when it comes to trying to understand what is happening to your data, whether or not proper security measures are being taken, right? Like, you get down to the core of the marmor of being able to predict what's going to happen with your data. I think most people who have PhDs in cybersecurity cannot read the legalese and possibly predict because the security stuff by itself is so complicated that it's basically impossible to anybody for anybody to predict anything.
Well, so I think the prediction there is ambiguous in a few ways that is important to distinguish. So, like, one is it's impossible to predict what some presently existing company may or may not do with your data. It might be impossible to predict what some collective group or some third entity is going to do with that data, with various other data that they've also collected, right? So they're making more sort of inferences given a bunch of different data sets. But there's also certain kinds of data collection that we're presently engaging in where nobody has at the moment any specific intention to use that data in any particular way, right? And so that's like the most abstract. Not only right. is it, well, it's hard for me to know what Google's going to do with this, it's like, no, the government wants to collect all of your biometric information for reasons they don't yet understand. You know, so we can kind of
right.
get more and more fuzzy on the prediction side of things.
And deeper into the fetal position.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's usually where we like to end off. And now that we've enjoyed this nice jaunt through the philosophical clouds, we can dive back into the political muck. Next episode, likely. Ready to talk about Joe Biden?
Okay.
Not yet. Give it a couple weeks. Anyways, thank you guys, and thanks everyone for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
See you later.
Oh, you want me to say something?
Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at @thebadlandspod. Thanks again for listening.